Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here, and before we start today's show, I first want to thank all our friends at patreon.com/vinylguide. These are the people who help keep this podcast going. I'm going to give them all a shout out at the end of the interview, but for the newest members, Aaron Goodrich, Robbo444, David Zimgrodsky, Caitlin O'Connor, and Sam Cohen, thank you so much for your support. Everyone else, please consider joining the patreon.com/vinylguide community. You get early access to episodes, extended interviews, and more, plus it helps keep this show going. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and we thank you in advance for your support.
Hi, this is Tim Minchin. I'm talking about my new album, Apart Together, on The Vinyl Guide.
Oh, well, thank you, Tim. And hey, everyone, it's Nate here. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are talking with Tim Minchin, composer, songwriter, comedian, pianist, author, writer, and all-around nice guy. Tim's got a wonderful new album, Apart Together, which you can listen to on streaming services and even order a vinyl copy from timminchin.com. Now, if you're new to Tim's work, just go up on the YouTubes. There's plenty of material to watch and enjoy. Plus, his new album is available on Spotify, Apple Music, and the other streaming services. You could dial that up right now. Now, Tim, as you may know, he's quite prolific. He started out as a comedian, which we'll talk about quite a bit today. There's some interesting intertwination between our stories. Tim has toured the world over. He's written lyrics and music for many Broadway shows, including Matilda and Groundhog Day. He's filled the Royal Albert Hall many times. He's acted in projects like Upright, Californication, the 2018 Robin Hood, and he continues to break new ground and extend his creativity through various projects. And I must say, the continued popularity of Tim Minchin really gives me hope. And not just because we're fellow Australians, but look, here's a guy who's supremely talented, he's original, he's honest, he's hardworking, and he's been rewarded with opportunities and adulation. Tim's rise and continued popularity tells me there is the possibility of justice in this world. I know he's blushing at this, or perhaps not even agreeing with me, but look, Tim, you're going to have to sit down and take these compliments, mate, because you've done well, and that holds true for the new album. Apart Together is available on all streaming services, so dial it up now. Chances are good you'll enjoy it to the point of picking up a vinyl pressing from timminchin.com. And a real quick shout out to show sponsor Groovewasher.com, the best record cleaner on Earth, and likely Mars and Jupiter too. Look, you've got to clean your records, people. You spend all that money, make the most of the audio benefits of vinyl by cleaning your records with the Groove Washer. The Groove Washer's G2 fluid is the best on the market and safest too. Clean and store your records with confidence. Ask your local record shop for the Groove Washer by name or go to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10. That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And of course, don't forget about audiophileusa.com, the online record shop that sells the most pristine used records available. AudiophileUSA.com only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records, much of it in original shrink wrap, some of them actually still sealed after decades. You can't beat that. That's as mint as vinyl gets. And AudiophileUSA.com ships worldwide, so wherever you are, Seattle, Berlin, Sydney, or Singapore, AudiophileUSA.com can get you your final upgrades on your holiest of grails. That's AudiophileUSA.com. And finally, don't forget, there are hundreds of other episodes of The Vinyl Guide ready for your enjoyment, including last week's episode with Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, episode 247 featuring Rat Scabies of the Damned, episode 242 with Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth, episode 241 with Rob Halford of Judas Priest, episode 237 with Guy Pratt of Pink Floyd, episode 235 with Jay Bentley of Bad Religion, and tons more. Just subscribe on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on Stitcher, Sonnet, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with the upfronts done, let's get into today's conversation with Tim Minchin.
Thank you. Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm just wandering around looking for my motherfucking headphones. Oh, there you go. I'm wiring up, brother. These Apple headphones, I mean, say what you like about Apple. They're pretty freaking good.
You're still on the cables, too.
I know. Old school. All right. There's your deck in the background.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Yes. Well, this is actually the downstairs one, the downstairs collection. Upstairs is where I have the nice comfy chair, and that sucker right there, that's a 1924 gramophone.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah. Nearly 100 years old.
Where do you live? In Sydney?
I'm up on the North Shore of Sydney.
Nice. How long have you lived in Sydney for?
Since 2001.
Nice.
November 7th, I remember, because it was Melbourne Cup Day.
Right.
And
what the hell is this?
I got from the airport. I had a bag. I had a guitar. I took it to the flat, and I went straight to the pub. I was like, I love this country already.
Yeah,
this is just so good. Perfect. Yeah. And welcome back home, by the way. You've had a whirlwind few years.
Yeah. I guess 15 years or 14 years. No, I guess it was 12 years overseas by the time we got to Sydney, but we'd never lived in Sydney either. So we're still starting again. You know, we're still on a journey of trying to figure out where the hell we belong.
So there's a lot to cover, and I want to get through it all. But for a few minutes, I want to tell you a little bit of a story.
Yes, please.
Because I've never told this story on the show. In fact, I'm not even sure I told many of my friends about it, but it does involve you. You are in this story.
Yeah, well, as a narcissist, that's very important.
So, in fact, you feature in it. So, the year is 2005. The setting is the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And I believe that was the year where you premiered the show Dark Side.
That's correct.
So, I remember that was the show you ended up grabbing some awards. It launched you to Edinburgh, where you got the Perrier Award. So, it was a big event.
Yeah, it's the origin of everything.
It is. Okay, so that's the big bang.
Yeah, that's ground zero.
So, that same year, in that same RMIT little theater was the launch of my comedy career, which went on a decidedly different trajectory, let's be clear. But I was actually part of the comedy group that rented that same theater just before your show. So I think ours was like at 6 to 7, and then you came on at 7:15 or 7:30 to 8. So you were essentially directly after our group.
Wasn't that Ronnie Jones?
No, it was Mike in Transit.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, about 7 comics from Sydney doing really bad Bill Hicks impersonations and just kind of feeling our way through it.
I totally had forgotten that. That's amazing.
Most people have, actually.
Well, my excuse is that I've forgotten most things. Not sure why.
Well, at that particular juncture, you know, there was a handful of us. We go up on stage, we do 10 minutes or so and turn it over to the next person. We're just kind of feeling our way through it. And I remember you would be kind of in the back area. I won't even call it a green room.
Like a tiny
waiting backstage area.
Yeah,
it was like a cell. I remember it was just dark and dank. And I remember, you know, we'd walk by kind of the area, the door, the room that you would be in. And you were always like, I think, staring at the ceiling. You were always doing something very intense. Like, I think, we imagine kind of you're going through your act in your head and maybe praying or doing whatever it was. You know, you're keeping very much to yourself. And I remember us, you know, there was no judgment. It was like, well, you know, everyone kind of prepares for their show in their own way. And, you know, this is the way he does it.
Yeah.
So I happened at that Melbourne Comedy Festival, I was able to score a gig at Melbourne Town Hall, essentially doing about 7 minutes opening for Arj Barker.
Uh-huh.
And for a comic, I mean, a first year comic, it was just an insane opportunity.
Huge.
Absolutely.
Huge room. And Arj was a huge comic.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a big name in Australia.
Absolutely. And I think the room, Melbourne Town Hall, is about 1,500 people or something. And I'd just been used to that point, you know, doing comedy in front of, you know, drunk punters or whatever. And so I was intimidated.
Yeah.
And I was still kind of working on myself, like trying to figure out, you know, how do I deal with stage fright? You know, I've got a, yeah. I've got a good 10, 12 minutes, but I have to do that. My crowd play is shit. You know, I can't improvise that much. So yeah. I'm still kind of feeling my comfort levels around.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to prepare for that town hall gig, I devised a plan in this RMIT theater. I'm going to do my set in this RMIT theater. I'm going to do it nude.
Oh,
I'm going to do it nude. And that way I've reasoned that, okay, everyone's worst fear is kind of, you know, showing up to school or work with no pants on or something like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what, if I do this, if I actually go out there and do my act naked in front of these, you know, probably 4 dozen people, then I will have survived. I will have gone through the worst. I will have conquered, and then I will be impervious because the worst has happened to me and I will have lived to tell about it. So I talked to the RMIT people. I say, you know, can I do this? Can I do it? Right. And they said, well, no one's ever asked that before, but they cited, you know what? There may be a health code violation.
Do you know
there
what? May be... I'm starting to remember this. Okay. I fucking remember this. Oh man. I'm starting to remember this. Okay. Keep talking. Holy shit. I remember this.
So you will remember that I'm not a handsome man.
That is an abject untruth. How dare you? You're a thing of great beauty.
Oh, no, my wife, thank God she's got bad eyesight, because I tell you, I've clearly exceeded my genetic potential. Anyway, so I go out on this stage, and the compromise with the RMIT people was like, okay, you could do it in your underwear. You can't do it totally naked because, you know, there's probably some law you'd be breaking. We don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So I went in my underwear, which was not boxers, not briefs, kind of the little, you know, tidy thigh things, right?
Yeah.
And as you go on stage, you know, there's the, your eyes kind of adjust. There's just, it's a sea of darkness initially. And and all I hear in the darkness is my wife cackling.
Did she know you were going to do it, or was it a surprise for her?
No idea. I did it. This is all within about 5 minutes before I went on, which I think is generally a really good time to make decisions like that. Anyway, so
I fucking remember this.
So I do my act, and the first few minutes, people are uncomfortable, obviously. And then I get through it. It went all right. I was surprised. Wow, the material carried through this grotesque visual that everyone was getting displayed.
I think I watched it from the side of stage.
I know you did, because as I walked back, the room that I would generally pass through the door and you were kind of staring at the ceiling, just kind of trying to get your head together, you were looking at me, staring at me like, what the fuck just happened? And it's one of these visuals that I have just frozen in my mind, is like, okay, well.
That's so good. I remember, but I remember that. I think I can almost bring to mind the light glinting off the curve of one of your testicles. I really do remember it.
Yes. There would have been a lot of shading and activity there. So.
So good. And how did the town hall gig go? Do you think did it work?
It went fantastic. In fact, it was the biggest crowd that I'd played, obviously, to that point. And it was this energy that I couldn't go to sleep. It was one of these things to where I know now why performers, when they go up and they have a good show, it's a good crowd, the crowd gives them energy, and then it must be really hard to wind down at the end. Is that what you find as well?
Yeah, well, I think curtain to bedtime's 3 to 4 hours and a bottle of wine, yeah. I mean, it depends what you want to do. The trouble with a lot of performers, try and stay up there because the crash is too sad. And that's when they get in trouble with drugs and stuff. But I've got it down to less wine and less time, but not much. I've just had to learn to accept. Often if the curtain comes down at 10:30, it's often about 3, 4, it's often over 4 hours, yeah.
It must be this lonely moment that you hit from, you know, having all that energy and all that adoration to then kind of being back at the, in the car on the way to the hotel.
Yeah.
It must be just huge contrast.
Yeah. I call it the Kylie syndrome, because Kylie once in an interview spoke about that moment of being in a hotel room, you know, because when she tours, she has her own room. She doesn't tour with a partner or anything, and just going, you know, a minute ago I was Kylie Minogue and now I'm a person alone in a hotel room, you know, like, and I think it sometimes feels weird, but the more you do it, the yeah, the trouble with all these sorts of things, these the cognitive dissonance of 3,000 people standing up and clapping you and then just being you, you know, under the harsh lights of a hotel room with your middle-aged belly and, you know, having a piss, you know, wishing you could empty your bladder more as easily as you could when you were 16. That kind of dissonance is only a problem if you think it's a problem. It's just like all discomfort in life. You just go, oh, well, that feels weird, but I'm not going to fucking try and solve it. I'm not going to take drugs or go to a psychologist. I'm just like, well, of course it feels a bit weird. Mm-hmm. So it's just about being cool with it feeling a bit weird, and the more you do it, the more you just go, oh yeah, it's that feeling. But I get off stage and like drink half a bottle of red wine in minutes. It's just trying to offset the adrenaline.
Now, you've got a lot of lyrics to remember, a lot of rhymes. Does a glass of wine improve or harm a show beforehand?
Well, I've always been of a mind that a glass of wine, so back to 2005 and me staring at the ceiling. I mean, I was 30, 29, and I felt like I was onto something. I kind of had a sense that year I wasn't in your headspace of, I want to try this out. I felt like I'd been playing music and acting and performing for 9 years, and I felt like a bit of an outsider because I was a bit weird looking and not the sort of person who gets acting gigs on Neighbours. And I felt like a bit of an outsider of the music industry because I wasn't a smoking stoner, you know, shuffling working class, venting my pain rocker. I just had a sense that year that what I had figured out, that this coal-eyed, big-haired grand piano, and that was the gig where I said, I want a grand piano. And that's why I went to RMIT, because I had a grand piano. Even though no one knew who I was and no one gave a shit, I went, I need a grand piano. I'm going to go high status, low status, right? Mm-hmm. And I was taking it very, very seriously. I thought, this is a fucking chance to have a career. And I was very nervous and wanted to be very, very good. And I wanted it to be impeccable. And, of course, I didn't achieve that, but I achieved something down the path to something very tight.
Mm.
And I was very worried about my vocal health. I was very worried that I was going to lose my voice in this, you know. And so that I was basically taking it very seriously. And so the person you saw staring at the ceiling was not drinking and was sucking lozenges and dealing with that anxiety of, I have to do 28 shows in 30 days for the first time and the audience is growing. And I bring all that up because I then went and did Edinburgh, and the same, I didn't drink. I was so anxious. And so I started that festival that we did together with 30 people in the room. And by the end of, I think 150 people fitted in that theatre. And I think by the final night of the festival, I had filled it. By the time that year was over, I had performed two songs at the Royal Albert Hall in between Mariah Carey and Westlife. That was the beginning of a fucking crazy year of having to have a look at yourself in the mirror and go, can you do this? Are you a person who can walk out in front of 3,000 people and hold your nerve? Mm-hmm. It's very much what you're talking about with your undies and the town hall. That kind of like, well, hold on, I was just starting my career, but I'm now at the town hall with Arj Barker, and I have to figure out what your undies experiment was a test. Am I brave, you know? And that year was my Am I Brave year. And the footage of that Royal Albert Hall performance of Inflatable You, I've watched it. I never watched myself, but I've watched it over the years. And I watched myself walk out on stage at, you know, 29 and look up. And I can see in my eyes the moment I felt where I went, fuck yeah, I can do this. And I remember it. I remember being really nervous, but walking out on stage and going, yeah, yeah, fuck yeah. I'll make these people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, only 5 years later, I was filling that hall several times by myself. But those moments are hugely transitional. And I bring all that up, I guess, just trying to get back to a glass of wine, because What I then did is got very relaxed and got to the point where I could play a 10,000 seat venue. And I worked really hard on taking away all the ritual. I went, I'm not superstitious. I want to be able to do this job, whether I've got the flu, whether I'm having to rush off stage at interval to have diarrhea, which I've had, or have a bucket by the piano, which I've had. I want to be able to do it if I've had the most stressful day of my life, if I haven't had time to warm up, if there's no dressing room, if no one, you know, if my rider isn't there. I want to be able to do it because I have a craft that I can do, not because of some magic formula.
Did you find yourself being a bit superstitious? Did you find yourself kind of going to the rhythm?
Well, no, but I guess I, for a while there, thought I had to have this cup of tea and that. Not superstitious, but I thought a ritual was a good idea. And that is so rife in our industry. But I actually decided to go the other way. And I've done it with my writing too. I can write anywhere. I don't need a special hat or a magic pen or a beautiful room with a view of a lake. I want to be able to write a song anywhere because it's not about the rest of that stuff. But I did get very relaxed, and the only ritual I had over the years was like I'd have a big glass of red wine and then a Red Bull before I went on stage. So a little bit of a nerve settler and then a little bit of a jumpy round. Yeah, fucking disgusting. But this last tour, so, you know, the tour before COVID killed it, the November last year in the UK, I went, you know what, I'm 44, I'm a fucking father. These people have paid proper money to see me, that I'm going to do these gigs sober. I want to be really good. I don't want to be a bit loose. I want to be really good. So it was a bit of a reversion to how you met me, staring at the ceiling. I went, come on, this is not your right to have this audience. This is an obligation and you need to be really sharp. I had a couple of nights where I was a bit loose on my lyrics and stuff. So I stopped and reverted to only drinking red wine after the show. Yeah.
But the Red Bull stayed.
Actually, that's a lie. I started having one at interval. Okay.
So in 2005, the character that you have, I mean, was pretty well there. The hair, the eyeliner, the pantomime, and that character.
Yeah.
Actually, do you refer to that character as a third person?
I tend to talk about him, but I tend to talk about him always. Like, we were filming a music video this week and I'd be like, and so he's going to be on stage and then he's going to walk down, you know, not because it's a character, but because we're talking from a different point of view. That sounds a bit weird. But by the way, that character had been really the hair, the eyes and the overcoat that got developed within the three months of when I met you. So it was all very new. It just all coalesced, you know.
Yeah, because I imagine there was probably some experiments like, oh, maybe he'll have blue hair. No, let's not do that. Let's, you know. But that came together rather quick and very successful, the combination. So there must have been some truth in each of those elements that constructed that character.
Yeah, he really was just, I mean, he's just me. I understood that my shtick was that the show was sort of virtuosic, you know. So there's elements of like a Beethovenian or Mozartian. So it's funny if someone's saying fuck, 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 you know, God's a cunt, whilst playing piano very well, you know. And at that stage, I wasn't a very good pianist and I forced myself to get better through that period of realizing there was an audience for this stuff. But I was good enough that people went, holy shit, Cat can play the piano.
Yeah. Well, up to that point, you had tried to have a traditional music career, yeah? Was that Timmy the Dog? Is that the original act that you thought was aligned to you?
Oh, no. I mean, it's always more complicated than that. I mean, firstly, I've always written music for theater and acted and stuff. But to the extent that I was trying to do original music, yeah, I thought one of the strands of that I was trying to do, I was trying to be an actor and I was trying to be a muso and I was trying to be a theater composer. But I sort of thought the theater composing thing was a bit of a cop out, you know. I thought, oh yeah, well, you do that if you can't be a rock star, right? But I had a band called Moon Unit with my brother when I was like 13, and then a band called Arnold, and then I think we were briefly called the Flaming Archipelagos when we were about 14. And I then, when I went to Melbourne just before the comedy stuff took off, my band was called Rosencrantz. And so Timmy the Dog was just the one that we put a reasonable album, a reasonable at-home demo album down with. Mm-hmm.
But stepping into comedy is a whole different world at that point. What gave you the confidence, the idea to try doing what I guess is musical cabaret comedy?
Well, I think just like the character, it was all just, I didn't step into comedy. I have always known that when I'm on stage, I'm pretty happy and relaxed and I sharpen up. You know that feeling where you're feeling a bit flat and then you get on stage and you're suddenly able to think quicker. And I always had a real sense, even just doing my little gigs or even my cover bands or wedding bands, I was able to be entertaining on stage. So I didn't see myself as stepping into comedy. I was just, my original cabaret show, the year, 2 years before we met in October 2003 at the Melbourne Fringe, was called Naval Cerebral Melodies with Umbilical Cords. And that was actually the show that made me go, holy shit, people laugh a lot when I do this stuff. And that had Inflatable You in it and it had Rock and Roll Nerd in it. And I had short hair and I was already wearing bare feet, short hair and a t-shirt and jeans and a keyboard and a drummer and a bass player. But I would do a poem and then I would do a weird monologue about working in a waxing salon and then a swing tune and then like a pseudo heavy metal song. And it was just variety, right? It's a variety show, like something you'd put in a burlesque tent. And I often played in burlesque tents. And then I just started sharpening up my talk and I realized that I kind of could do it. I mean, I never called myself a stand-up and I'm not that interested in stand-up as a career, but I kind of just figured out my version of it. And suddenly I thought, well, if I put myself in the comedy festival instead of the fringe festival and call myself a comedian, people buy tickets. And that was that.
Now, after the success in 2005 and, of course, Dark Side, you then went on to write what became So Rock.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like starting with, I'm assuming it was a bit of a blank slate. You had done all your A material at that point, put it into Dark Side. What was it like then staring at kind of what that next level was going to be?
Well, I was lucky because in the couple of years before Dark Side, I'd done all these gigs at the Butterfly Club in South Melbourne and I was writing shit all the time. So I went to my material that didn't make it to Dark Side and kind of pimped it up. So things like Perineum, Millennium, The In-Between Years, I actually wrote at university 15 years before. Mm. And, you know, I wrote a few new songs and then I was trawling the bottom drawer and it was fine. But really, I think of So Rock as a kind of treading water moment. And when I then recorded my first DVD, which was called So Fucking Rock, it was an amalgamation of Dark Side and So Rock. And really that for me represents, well, my first sort of live show that actually, you know, that was when I was playing 1,000-seat theatres and filming a special and stuff. And so those first two shows for me are all sort of one thing, really.
Has your writing discipline changed from the early days? Like, do you wake up each day and do you have a set time that you sit down to the piano and start working things out?
Yeah. Not really, because it totally depends on what I'm doing, because sometimes I'm touring and, you know, when I wrote Matilda, I rented a space and caught the bus there every day and tried to get there by 10 because I was on a hugely demanding deadline because our second child was about to be born. And, you know, but in the last 3 years, I've mostly been writing television and I go to the production company and sit around a table with four other writers. And when I was writing Groundhog Day, I was mostly in a warehouse with the director and it's collaborative. And so it just changes all the time. I don't really have any routine or even any discipline. What I have is a huge amount of work to get done.
Mm.
So it's not that I'm disciplined. It's that I say yes to shit and then I'm screwed. And then I have to just wake up and start working, whether that is getting in an Uber to a production company or whether it's sitting down at my piano or going to my computer. And of course, like everyone these days, I spend hours each day just managing my business, just answering emails and talking to my manager and my accountant and my fucking, I don't know, endless. my job is like anyone's job. It's a huge amount of admin.
And I've never had a PA. I actually am just my sister post COVID is starting to help me out because mm-hmm. COVID killed her industry too. So it's not so much discipline as survival.
So when it comes to the creative process, the song doesn't necessarily start with the theme or the lyrics or music. It actually sounds like it begins with a deadline.
Yeah. Well, often, except to sort of briefly fast forward to this album, this last 2 years has been amazing, sometimes stressful, full of self-doubt, but a time where I've, for the first time since comedy took off, first time since Timmy the Dog, I've sat down and gone, I'm just going to write a song mm-hmm. that I feel. I'm actually going to trawl my fucking feelings. I'm going to dig down and see what I think about stuff. And it's why the album's a bit contemplative and stuff, but still whimsical and still quirky sometimes, but mm-hmm. it's quite sort of honest. And so, yes, up until the last 2 years, I'd say it's mostly been about deadlines. But of course, that doesn't make it less creative, because if the deadline is we need a song in the second act, we don't have a song in the second act for Matilda, and I have to turn up to my piano one day and go, okay, I'm 5 and I'm a genius, and this is the moment around I have to decide where I first do telekinesis with my eyes. What is going on in my head? What does that feel like musically and lyrically, that energy buildup of passion and confusion? And, you know, mm-hmm. so it's a really, I love it. The creative process for me is hard and very intellectual. You know, it's very, it's not like, oh, it's very thoughtful, not just an outpouring. You know, you can tell from all my stuff. I'm not just pouring my feelings out. I'm trying to construct stuff. Yeah, so it's quite nerdy, the whole thing. But you're absolutely, between 2004 and 2017, I've just been getting shit written because it needs to be written.
I mean, I would imagine your work ethic is quite rigid. And yeah, I know you're saying it may not be, but for where you've gone the last 15 years through television shows, acting, creating several scores, you were appointed a member of the Order of Australia. I mean, there are so many projects. You've written books. What sort of projects do you say no to?
That's a good question. I say no. So a big thing for me is that I want to keep getting better. Mm-hmm. Like I see the whole, I feel like I've just got started and that I want to do lots of things, and I don't want to be shit at them. I don't want to do them for vanity. I want to do them because I've always loved acting. I've always loved mm-hmm. stories, and I've always loved poems, and I've always loved songs. And, you know, I want to do them because I feel like I have an authentic offer. You know, it's a genuine desire to create work. I say no to things if I think I'm going to be I'm not ready to be the uncle in the room. I still want to be the apprentice. Mm. Now, obviously, that's kind of disingenuous, because often in rooms these days, not only do I have the final word, but I want the final word. But I tend not to say yes to things if I think everyone's just going to be turning to me all the time saying, what do you want, Mr. Minchin, or how are you going to solve this? I want to be held to account and to have strong voices, and ideally I want mentors still. So I say yes to things that I think, oh shit, that's going to be a challenge, and working with that cat, I'm going to learn a lot. Other than those projects, I just do things like this album and my stuff that is very much just my stuff.
Whose career do you look at now admirably and see it as an example for where you can go next?
I think the aim is to have one that no one's ever had before. Yeah, I think I've got the best career of anyone in the world. I think I do.
Certainly top 10 to me, I would
say. Well, I just go, what career would I rather have than mine? And I cannot think of one. I mean, who the fuck gets to do what I do? Who gets to write a musical and then play Judas and then make a TV show with amazing people and mm-hmm. act and then be a ironic rock star and then be an unironic rock star and then make an album and publish a children's book and do charity stuff? And, you know, it's just so much fun.
Oh, absolutely. But I would imagine at this point, you're not out of challenges yet. You're already thinking about, okay, what do I do now? How do I express my creativity?
Yeah, I think what I want to do, I think now,
sort of as of this album, I'm at a point where I don't need to push out into any new areas, except I'd like to write a book, mm-hmm. like a sort of nonfiction, not autobiographical by any means, but a sort of, mm-hmm. yeah, anyway, I guess I'll write a book one day and I guess I'll direct a bit more. But now I just want to, what have I got left? I mean, I'm 70 in 25 years. So,
well, look what you've done in the last 15. I mean,
well, that's right. But I guess that means if I aim to write three more musicals, put out three more albums, do a tour every 2 years, so 12 more tours, make three more TV shows, a couple of feature films, and write a couple of books, that's it, right? I'm done. I'll run out of time at about that point. So yeah, I'm not really looking to push out in many directions. And when I say, I think it probably says something about my personality and hopefully not something bad, that I really do not think about other people's careers particularly, certainly not aspirationally. Mm-hmm. I just go, shit, what do I get to do now? And a lot of my decisions are based on being careful mm-hmm. to fulfill my duties as a father and husband and stuff. So a hell of a lot mm-hmm. of my decisions, although it might not look like it, have been making sure, like, I've moved away from the places I'm most famous. Like, I've moved back to Australia, which is not the best thing for my career, and I've said no to presenting panel shows because I didn't want to get more famous in England, and I said no to sitcoms based on my life because I don't want my life to be trawled. I try to do projects that are not going to make me ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly want to be a household name. I don't want to be always recognized on the street. I'm still at a point where if I tuck my hair up and put my glasses on, I can get about. So I've made all those decisions as well. It's not actually all about ambition, and it's certainly not about trying to emulate. Mm-hmm.
So with the new album, Together Apart, this is a collection of songs. Did these songs come together while you were writing others? Like, if you are working on a given day, you create something, do you sometimes have the musical pile or the solo album pile, or was it a conscientious objective to create a Tim Minchin album?
It's the latter, yeah. So after LA, or during the final year of LA, when we had decided, we had decided years ago that we were going to go back to Australia, but we had set the date to return to Australia, and Groundhog Day had opened on Broadway and my film had been shut down and Robin Hood was in the can and all that stuff, I basically went, my next thing is an album. And although lots of things have happened since then and I've toured and stuff, the main creative project for the last couple of years has been trying to make a record, which has been weird because I didn't know who I was by that stage, right? I've written for so many other projects and other voices. I was like, well, what does a me record sound like now? Mm-hmm. And so it's been a bit of an exploration sort of thing.
And what do you think this new album adds to the story, to the catalog of recordings?
What do you think, Nate? That's what I want to know.
I think it's a much more serious album. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still that playfulness, that mirth, mm-hmm. but it feels like if we're to talk about that character, that, you know,
yeah.
part Elton, part Charlie Chaplin guy.
Yeah, yeah,
he
yeah.
He seems to have matured. He seems to have grown up. That's what I got out of it.
Yeah. I think he's gone away.
You think he's totally gone?
Yeah, I think he's gone away, really, except that, you know, his DNA, that character's DNA is intellectual curiosity. So obviously that hasn't gone away because it's quite a sort of curious, contemplative record. But I think the showing off isn't there, I suppose. I mean, or at least it's not meant to be. Mm-hmm. The character of my comedy career, as I said, is sort of meant to be virtuosic. You know, with the orchestra show that my comedy career sort of ended on or peaked on. Well, that's when I sort of went, okay, I've done that and I'll do other stuff now. It's spectacular, you know. And I say that with all, you know, I can't bear to watch myself and I don't love my playing and I don't love my voice and I think I'm a dickhead. But as a piece of entertainment, it was quite, with that orchestra and those lights and the density of ideas and the density of lyrics and the loquaciousness and the playfulness with language, it was it's meant to be razzle dazzle. It's meant to be showing off. Mm-hmm. It's meant to make you go, holy shit. This record's not meant to make you, it's not trying to show you how clever I am. at all. I hope not, anyway. It's meant to just make you feel, think about some shit that happens in life that you might not have thought about in those terms before, like love being decay and, you know, wondering whether you'll be cool if you are about to face a violent death. And, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. I hope it's really entertaining, but it's not burlesque anymore.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. My wife and I listened to it the other night, and we're used to seeing the Tim Minchin character through the keyhole of that character.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, obviously you've had the time within yourself to understand the variation, but that's who we thought of when we were listening to it. And we discussed it. It's like, it seems like that character, again, it's matured, it's gone beyond, but there is still that playfulness and making points like, you know, women in Porsche SUVs tend to look miserable.
Yeah.
That's totally North Shore. I totally get that. So there's these
and that does, that is the sort of thing that is a song that old character might have written.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've very consciously decided that we don't live in a time that needs more polemicists. I think when back in our day at RMIT, I felt, and I don't think I was wrong, that there was room for polemic, that, you know, and all the way through to Cardinal Pell and all that, that there is a time and a place to say that is fucking bullshit and those people don't deserve our respect. However, in a post-Twitter world, everyone's a polemicist. Mm. I would argue that they're not very good ones because they don't rhyme. But I have sort of, certainly this album and the difference between where I am now and where I was when I did comedy is that one of my main tools was polemic, was eviscerating ideas. And I am desperate that in this era, in this post-Trumpian, divisive, post-Russian interference mm-hmm. world, I'm desperate to put out healing stuff. And it doesn't mean you have to get all Hallmark card. But with Groundhog Day and Upright and this record, the three major works of the last 5 years in my life, they are all addressing the question of how are you meant to live a good life in a tough universe. You know?
Yeah. Well, more outrage is just exhausting at this point.
It is. It is. There's no. I don't want to be part of it anymore.
Yeah. Now you seem to have kept yourself extremely well grounded. You know, throughout the last few decades, still married, family devoted, approachable, attitude has matured but not soured. How do you avoid the trappings of that rise and becoming as well known as you are?
Well, it's nice that you say that. That actually means a lot that people like you who have seen me over many years feels like I think a trap I have fallen into, which rises up when I'm doing a lot of press, is you are obliged to talk about yourself a lot, and even on this podcast. So I'll hang up the phone from you in 10 minutes or whatever and go, fuck, I talked too much and stayed too long. You know, I'll have remorse that I, you know, I always feel like I should be asking how your last 15 years have been and stuff, but I know that's not the job right now.
I still have the gut.
You're still
not
still
nearly
beautiful.
Enough sit-ups.
Do you still wear tighty undies?
I do, actually. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, me too. Once you've started, you never go back. I think self-obsession is the trap, really, mm-hmm. in that when people are always asking about your work, when you make something, a lot of people take notice. It's very hard not to get your internal monologue is like, and when people recognize you on the street, there's a reason why famous people are fucked up, basically. Your internal eye tends to move outwards, so you start observing yourself. You start observing yourself from the outside a bit. It's totally natural and totally understandable
mm-hmm.
that you start worrying about who you are and how you appear and all that. And that's not healthy for humans. You should mm-hmm. keep your sense of self inside, and you should keep your self-esteem as something that is strengthened by your family and friends, not by what someone says about you in a blog or whatever. And so a big part of it for me is not reading about myself or Googling myself or anything. So I do that. But it's just Sarah, really, and the kids. I mean, I'm very, very good friends with my wife, and my wife doesn't give a shit about all this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't read interviews about me either. And she loves me and appreciates my work, but she doesn't think it makes me anything special. And I suppose that's a huge part of it. But more than anything, I just come from a really loving, really tight, really no-nonsense family. Mm-hmm. And my values were fixed long before that moment when I walked out on the stage in Royal Albert Hall. My values were already there. My wife was already pregnant. My understanding of the value of family and ethical responsibility and paying your tax and all those things, they were already there. Mm-hmm. So a big thing is don't get famous young. Spend your 20s poor. Spend your 20s poor. It's a song that I've never finished writing, but I think it's a very good idea.
So what's the biggest rock star thing you've ever done? I mean, $20,000 bottle of wine. What was the one indulgence that you could remember like, oh shit, yeah, that was peak rock star?
I just don't. I mean, I just would never buy an expensive bottle of wine. I mean, I buy fucking expensive wine, but I'm talking $100 relative to...
Right.
I don't take drugs. I've never had an orgy. Well, no. I've never had an orgy. My stuff is very quaint. When Groundhog Day opened in London, we were living in LA and we rented a big country house in the Cotswolds and asked all our friends to come and stay with us for a week in this beautiful country house in the Cotswolds. And for the night that Groundhog Day opened, I rented a two-story rock bus to drive us to London to see the show and then drive us back to the Cotswolds. Mm-hmm. So that's about as rock and roll as I get. I can't, I mean, my God, we've had some, on my British tour last year, we had an amazing tour bus and we had some bloody good times, but it's red wine and cheese good times, not cocaine and sex workers.
No, you never considered buying a tiger.
You've never done it. I mean, yeah, I've considered it, but the difference is I didn't do it, you see. Don't worry, I think about it all night. I don't know. I bought a few acres of rainforest. Hmm. That's what I've done. There you go. That's pretty rock star.
Well, that also goes back to the charitable, authentic individual that
I'm pretending to be.
No, you're not pretending. Don't be coy. You are probably one of the nicest, most approachable people that I've had the pleasure to deal with and had on the show. And I got to tell you, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure watching your career over the years. And I've, even though I wasn't born here in Australia, over the last couple of decades, I feel I've become Australian, and watching what you've done and the path that you've followed is really made me proud to be part of this community. So I got it to end this new album, Apart Together. Again, the songs are really beautiful. There's the lyrics that are within are really well considered and authentic. Again, not to overuse that word, but again, I'm really happy for you, mate. You've had a wonderful career, and this album is just another step in that brilliance.
Thank you so much. That's incredibly kind. I'm gonna cry. No, that's really beautiful. Well, it means a lot. Thank you.
No worries.
Here, I'm putting my camera back on so I can see you.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, we got the...
Come on. Now that
you
I've
are
heard
crying.
The story.
You are crying.
Yeah. So, I'm wearing eye makeup.
Oh, yeah, it's running. So Together Apart is out on vinyl. This
apart,
is one of your...
Apart Together.
Apart. Is Apart Together? Together Apart?
It is Apart Together. You said it both ways during this, and I really like it. I like
that. Oh, okay.
It's changeable. Yeah.
So this is one of your first productions on vinyl. You don't have many records in your career.
It is my first. It's really my first released album ever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's my first vinyl. Here I am signing.
Oh, there's one right there. All right.
It's actually not. It's an insert, but I have to sign 2,000 of them sometime in the next, by 5 o'clock.
So you've got this album. Are you a vinyl collector? Do you listen to music on vinyl?
I started in the US, and I'm not an audiophile, and I'm not actually a great music fan. Mm-hmm. As in, I don't listen a lot. I'm a bit shit about that. But I have a reasonable collection, I guess, of 40 or 50 records now. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of jazz, really. I really like. I listen to a bit of jazz, and I really like jazz on vinyl. It feels right, you know.
Yeah, especially
to listen to those Yeah, listening to Ella on vinyl, or Etta James, or Miles, or, you know, it's
Horace Silver.
Yeah, so good.
All right. So again, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I want to remind everyone to check out Tim's new album, Apart Together. You can pick up a copy over at timminchin.com. There's a red vinyl version. There's a white and globby kind of vinyl version. Are there autograph versions that they could get from the website? Is that what they...
Yeah, there'll be autographs coming your way.
Oh, my goodness. And again, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I appreciate the opportunity to allow you to see me fully clothed.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, there we go, Mr. Tim Minchin. Great to reconnect with him after so many years. I got to tell you, it's an absolute pleasure just watching his star continue to rise, watching him go from strength to strength, and just continue to extend his talent. He really is marvelous. And his new album, Apart Together, is just as marvelous as he is. You can check it out on all streaming services, dial it up, try before you buy, but then head over to timminchin.com where they have different vinyl variants of which you can pick up. And he's also got a live streaming concert. I think if you go to timminchin.com right now, you could still catch the tail end of it. Maybe out there, maybe not. If not, check YouTube. But anyway, timminchin.com. Just go there and get a record, will you? All right, and that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. As promised, I'm going to give a shout-out to every single person who's part of our patreon.com/vinylguide community. You want to make this list? Be a friend of the show? Join now, patreon.com/vinylguide, and receive all the benefits of advanced episodes, extended interviews, and a bunch of other stuff that we put up there occasionally. All right, here we go. Huge thanks to Robbo444, Aaron Goodrich, David Zibgrodsky, Caitlin O'Connor, Sam Cohen, Miguel Alvarez, Chris Glue, Isaac, EM, Carolina Hidalgo, Patrick Thompson, Eric Lands, Brian King, Christian Death, Michael Scholar Jr., Chad Dyer, Tehejot, Tom Osman, Jason, Gregory Plass, Dayton Canley, Mike McGlinnan, Bruno Bissonette, Tom Beery, Chuck Boyd, John Raptus, Declan Phoenix, Ricky Harris, David Wellbeloved, Dan T, Trostles, Kevin Mosher, David Phillips, Regis Wack, Michael Howerton, James Dumont, John Lilliquist, David Messer, Michael J. Caluzzi, Tim Clifford, Jen DiEugenio, Timo Christofferson, Jason Maka, Sean Kenny, Jose Marcel Berto de Souza, and Sean Kelly. You are all rock stars. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope to keep bringing you the content that you love here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, anyone who wants to join this community can at patreon.com/vinylguide. We also appreciate people leaving us positive reviews on iTunes or Stitcher or Sonnet or wherever, and also sharing our episodes on social media. That's a huge help, so keep doing that. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.